Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
We're pleased to have today in this session two very eminent members of the RLDS Church, Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. As I was just chatting with them here, I realized that there may be members of the audience who are not familiar with some of the differing practices of the RLDS Church. We won't go into it, but we will say that Section 156, for those of you who are not sure what it meant, is concerning women in the priesthood, which is what Bill Russell will speak to us about today. Mr. Russell comes to us with a great deal of educational background. He went to Graceland College and also to the St. Paul School of Theology, which is a Methodist school, received a JD at the University of Iowa. He's done some editing and some writing. Some of you may have if you've read some Sunstones or Dialogues in the past, have seen things that he has written, as well as being the editor of our LDS publications, Priesthood and Leaders Journal, Stride, which is the name of their youth magazine, and also the Saints Herald, which incidentally originally was the True Latter-day Saints Herald. He's taught religion and history and political science at Graceland College since 1966, has a book called Treasures in Earthen Vessels, An Introduction to the New Testament. As I mentioned, various articles. He has two daughters, both of whom are University of Iowa students. And he must have indicated this about himself. He's a self-avowed political activist and just incidentally hosted Gary Hart at the Graceland College just 2 days before Gary Hart hosted Donna Rice. He says that he feels partially responsible for the problem because he failed to warn Gary Hart about temptations of the flesh. He also, incidentally, is a marathon runner and has run in many marathons, including the Boston, which is the big marathon. We'll be pleased to have responding to him Paul Edwards. Those of you who have been to symposiums in the past have heard Paul speak and know of his educational expertise. He was a teacher at Graceland College for 20 years and is now president of the Temple School in Independence, Missouri, since 1982. He's also the president of the High Priest Quorum in the RLDS Church, which is the highest of the High Priest Quorums in their church. He has three books and certainly many articles that we have written, that we have read and are familiar with. Without any further remarks from me, we'll turn the time now over to Bill Russell.
Thank you very much. It was in April of 1984 that at the RLDS World Conference in Independence that the prophet of the RLDS Church, Wallace B. Smith, presented a revelation which was accepted by the conference and therefore is now section 156 in the RLDS Doctrine and Covenants. And that revelation opened the door to admitting women in the priesthood, and the first women were ordained in late 1985, and there are several hundred now that are ordained. The responses to the revelation on women in the priesthood have been varied, and there are three general kinds of responses that have occurred, and they're fairly logical ones. One group of members, which is possibly the largest of these different segments, supported the new policy when it was first announced. There are many of these people had favored ordaining women in the priesthood prior to 1984. In fact, a survey taken from headquarters had shown about 35 or 40% of the members favored it prior to this happening. Second, and also a very large segment, was initially opposed to the idea, but they have come to accept it. Some in this camp switched positions merely because he had come by way of revelation, and they were willing to subordinate their personal view to the expressed will of the prophet. You know, these are the people who are willing to let the prophet do their thinking for them. Others in this group switched sides after hearing the issue debated, or they had personal experiences which led them to believe that they were wrong in their earlier opinion. For example, a Graceland faculty member, a friend of mine, said that he was opposed to it when it first came to the conference on Tuesday, but by the time the vote was taken on Thursday, he'd come to conclude that it was just personal prejudice on his part, and so he voted for Section 156, so that the debate and the discussion had changed him. A third group, also a very sizable group, was opposed at the outset and continues to be opposed to Section 156, that is, opposed to women in the priesthood. I'm not aware of anybody in a fourth category, and that is those who were in favor of women in the priesthood prior to the revelation, and then when God said we should have them change their position. an early visible show of their strength occurred, this is the opponents, occurred in April of 85 when 300 persons demonstrated in front of the building where the hierarchy have their offices in Independence. Many of these opponents feel that since God is unchangeable, which is a good RLDS doctrine, and since God had not called any women to the priesthood in the past, and they go back for millenniums, obviously he intends his priesthood to be all male. And they cite the various scriptures such as 1 Corinthians. In this third group, those who are still opposed to women in the priesthood, a sizable number still continue to attend the established RLDS congregations. In some cases, they control whole jurisdictions. Two stakes near the center place, including the one that Paul Edwards lives in, have turned down all priesthood calls for women, including some that Paul submitted. In the RLDS church, priesthood calls have to be approved by a vote of the members of the state conference. One of these stakes, Central Missouri stake, recently adopted a resolution calling for no ordinations in their stake for 5 years, a waiting period or moratorium, whatever, and they have not yet approved anybody. Other opponents have quit going to church altogether or begun to attend Protestant churches, usually of a fundamentalist variety. But finally, in the group that I'm going to focus on here, some opponents are now attending independent restoration branches that they have created, completely aside from the church. There are 1,000, I think probably several thousand, former RLDS members are now attending these independent branches. Some of them began before April 1984, but most of them have sprung up since Section 156 came into being. Many of these separatists have been upset. They had been upset at the liberal drift of the RLDS church before 1984, discernible in the leadership, I think, since at least in the late 1960s. Some began holding separate meetings well before this time. For example, I was the guest preacher by a strange quirk of fate at one such group way back in 1973. My sermon on love was interrupted by a woman who stood up and denounced me as a communist. But since April 1984, the number of these groups have grown, and the number of people have grown tremendously that are attending such groups. For many of these people, women in the priesthood was the last straw in what they saw as a growing apostasy in the church. The old Jerusalem gospel was being slowly replaced by a liberal Protestant theology that minimized the unique features of Latter-day Saintism. Many of these people are staying in the church and following the pattern of the earlier organization of the 1850s, that is, trying to keep the church functioning at the local level in a purer form via their own independent branches until the Lord moves to send new leadership to his church. I'm aware of several dozen RLDS separatist groups now holding their own separate worship services. In Lamoni, where I live, Lamoni, Iowa, we have two options for the dissatisfied fundamentalist RLDS member. One option is the group formed by a white man, Ron Livingston, who combines fundamental RLDS doctrine with a veneration for Indian culture and an attempt to imitate Indian ways. He's often referred to as Chief I'm a Wannabe by critics. There's also a larger and what I will call a more orthodox group meeting in a small town about 10 miles north of Lamoni. I've attended services at the Decatur City Restoration Branch on three occasions recently. They simply hold the standard Sunday school and preaching services on Sunday morning and the Wednesday night prayer service, which is very typical of the traditional RLDS congregation, such as the kind that Paul Edwards and I and most others RLDS our age grew up in 20, 30, and for Paul 40 or 50, 60 years ago. At Decatur City, the average attendance on Sunday morning is about 90. I would estimate that at least 15% of the people in Lamoni stake are attending one of these two groups. This would probably be the largest congregation in the state, second largest congregation in the stake next to Lamoni, if it were a congregation in the stake. Some groups, like I say, predated Section 156. One example is the Church of Jesus Christ Restored in Owen Sound, Ontario, which goes back to 1969. They recognize a prophet named Stan King. They report that 90% of their Canadian membership are former RLDS members. They claim a total membership of 25,000, before you get too shocked by that. Most of these are converts they've made in India. I don't know exactly what their Canadian membership is. They claim that their restographic operation brings in a six-figure income, so they've got a nice church business. And they claim they're going to soon have a seven-digit annual income. So they have a profit, and they're making a profit. They have purchased 200 acres of land, including a ski lodge, but so far no water slides. In November of 1985, they reported that our group does not yet have all things common, but we believe in and look forward to the United Order of Enoch. Well, with a seven-digit income, you might want to join that group. Another such group is in Vancouver, Washington, which had a split with church leadership about 10 years ago. And they had a fight over church building, and they went their separate ways about 1977. In the Independence area alone, today, now getting to post-1984, there are at least 10 groups holding separate worship services, separate from the institutional church, with probably close to 1,000 people attending in Independence alone. One is organizing a new church, and they're called Zion's Branch, and they have a prophet named John Cato and a bishop, and they're moving toward organizing a quorum of 12, and they have three branches. Another prophet in the Independence area is a man named Gene Walton, who started a group prior to Section 156, and he's got a little church going. The other separatist groups in Independence, though, do not see themselves as a new church, most of the people are in this category. Rather, they are worshiping as independent branches, trying to preserve their organization's brand of the Restoration. Some of these have fully organized branches and are baptizing, ordaining, dispensing the sacrament in these independent groups. The most fully organized of these groups is the Independence branch, pastored by Rudy Leitzinger, and includes Richard Price, the most famous publicist of the fundamentalist cause. They have about 150 members. Of similar size, but with limited organizational development, is the Glendale Gathering. There's also the Liahona branch, the Center Place branch, Southeast Independence, Zion's Remnant, and several others whose names I don't know, but I know they exist. One of the most significant groups exists in Michigan, where a district organization has been established with a district presidency and eight branches plus a larger number of missions. After withdrawing from the RLDS Church, their leader, Robert Buller, contacted the Vancouver branch and adapted their bylaws in establishing branches in Michigan, and they publish a periodical called The Rod of Iron. One group that is well on the way to becoming a new church is the Church of the Lamb of God. Originating in Beals, Maine, it has expanded from that location. They have a central office in Independence and collect tithing, and they are apparently considering formally organizing the leading quorums of the church. Well, I'm also aware of two congregations in Australia, two independent branches in Australia, independent groups in Miami, Oklahoma, Denver, Little Rock, Barberton, Ohio, Cameron and St. Joe, Missouri, Pueblo, Colorado, Talentsville, Oklahoma, Woodbine, Iowa, and I know there's a number of others that do exist. The RLDS hierarchy has not sat back silently as these fundamentalist members have criticized church leadership and set up separate groups. The hierarchy has fought back in several ways. One of them has been to silence dissident priesthood members. In our church, that means if you're silenced, you cannot function in your priesthood and until the silence is lifted by a proper administrator. Beginning about 1980, several dozen priesthood have been silenced for participating in separatist-type groups that the fundamentalists have organized. The main group here, early on anyway, was the Restoration Festival. They would hold occasional, once or twice a year, or maybe three or four times a year, weekend or week-long reunion-type meetings where they would gather and for the purpose of expounding the traditional RLDS gospel in song and preached word and prayer and testimony and so forth. And quite a few priesthood who took an active part in these meetings were silenced. They see themselves in a rather odd position of being silenced by the RLDS church leadership precisely because they're preaching good, sound, traditional RLDS doctrine. Second reaction of the hierarchy, the more extreme sanction of expulsion from the church has been taken against two independent persons, Dorothy Christina and Richard Price, who have both been very actively engaged in publishing materials criticizing church policy. Both were to be expelled. You're out completely. You'd have to be rebaptized to get back in. That's a greater sanction than excommunication, which simply is a temporary lifting of certain rights, but it's not an expulsion from the church. Price was expelled just last month in a big trial, or at least a big fuss about what was sort of a trial. A third response has been to remove pastors in the middle of their one-year terms of office, and these pastors are elected by the stake conference of all the members to these one-year terms. In the middle of the term, they've been removed by a stake president or a higher authority. For example, in Central Missouri Stake, one pastor published a letter in the Kansas City Star criticizing the church policy on women, and before the week was out, he'd been removed from his office. Earlier this year, Blue Valley Stake President Bill Barnhart, and that's in the Independence area, supported by Apostle Bill Higdon, announced the removal of four pastors and named their replacements. Unfortunately for them, the saints in these congregations rebelled, and none of the four pastors have been able to assume their post. In at least one of these congregations, they physically prevented the new pastor from entering the sanctuary, at least in the holier parts of the sanctuary, that Sunday. Good stout deacons were ordained or called to this duty. A fourth response, a rather extreme one, has been to close down congregations that were in resistance to church policy. That happened in Vancouver, Washington, about 10 years ago. But since Section 156, it's happened in McAllen, Texas. Some observers are expecting the hierarchy to close down some or all of these four congregations in Blue Valley Stake if that's not resolved, and it probably won't be. The fundamentalists in Blue Valley Stake have repeatedly shown they have a popular majority in stake conferences, therefore they could turn down Paul's recommendation for ordinations, for example. And some of you might be interested in the fact that one of these recommendations for ordination was Barbara Howard, assistant editor of the Saints Herald, wife of church historian Dick Howard, and she was one of those that they turned down, but they turned them all down. They were successful in resisting the removal of the fundamentalist pastors, as I said. So when they were getting ready to vote stake president Bill Barnhart out of office, void by these earlier successes, the hierarchy employed a new tactic. They said, let's not hold any stake conferences for a while till this thing kind of blows over. So while stake conferences are normally held every 3 months or so, there's not been one since December of 1986 in Blue Valley Stake, and who knows when there will be one. Finally, according to the fundamentalists, the hierarchy often applies personal pressure on members to keep them from participating in independent groups. For example, a couple of retired 70s who are fairly fundamental in their theology were invited to preach at Zion's Branch, and this was publicized. The hierarchy found out about it. They brought them in, twisted their arms. At least according to the fundamentalists in Zion's Branch, they withdrew from participation because of the pressure from the hierarchy. Both retired church appointees spent their life in the church's employ, and they listened to authority. In a hierarchical, authority-laden church like the RLDS Church, significant problems arise when one comes to the conclusion that the church has gone into apostasy. It is not surprising that independent branches have sprung up in various places around the church. Dissent to women in the priesthood probably exists in virtually every stake or district in the church. In some places, individuals with sufficient independent-mindedness or courage have started independent groups. In other locations, no one simply has stepped forward to do so. If the Restoration had adopted the congregational form of church government like the Baptists, well, then, of course, these groups would go on meeting separately, and that would be the end of it. But believing that the gospel requires a prophet and 12 apostles and bishops and so forth, called and ordained under proper divine authority, there's a need for the schismatic saints to come together and create a new leadership. And they must be convinced that this new leadership was appointed by God rather than man. With dozens of different groups meeting, each with the potential of believing one of their own is God's choice to succeed the fallen prophet Wallace B. Smith, then it would be easy to divide into many competing groups. So they will eventually need a prophet that all or most of the dissidents will recognize, or the movement's going to splinter into many small groups. So you might want to send your application letter and resume to Richard Price in Independence. The RLDS Church does not have a realistic mechanism for removing a bad prophet, as they see a bad prophet now exists. Nor do they have a mechanism for selecting a new one in his place, not a realistic one. The road ahead is not easy for these dissidents. Vern Elifson of River Falls, Wisconsin, and some of his associates realized soon after Section 156 was approved that independent branches were going to be needed. They were springing up, and he recognized there was a need for some communication between these independent branches. So they decided that in order to get the true church functioning again, the elders should be called together and see what they could decide about how to get the church on the right path once more. So Vern and his associates, 32 of them, sent out a letter to all the elders in December of 1984. And they said that the church is in disorder and they need to get it back in order. And they said, all elders who are willing to accept the following propositions are invited to a conference. That is, that the Church of Christ is in disorder. Obedient priesthood members, as part of their priesthood duties, have an obligation to restore order to his church. This restoration of order must be achieved in harmony with the requirements of the three standard books, as the Bible, Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants. And decisions must be arrived at on the basis of common consent. So billed as the International Elders Conference, because they had a handful of elders from Canada and Australia, they had four conferences. They have had four conferences in Independence. In April and November of 85, and in April of both 86 and 87. Early on, a seven-member steering committee was established to set the agenda for these conferences, and most of their questions revolved about what do we do now, given the apostasy of the church leadership. And so the agenda was sent out to their mailing list prior to their conferences. Things went well, it seems to me, at the first two conferences, but about 200 elders would attend most of the meetings. It appears that a great many of the independent branches from all over the church were in attendance. These representatives were in attendance. It contained members from the three members from the Independence area, the steering committee did, three from Independence, two from Michigan, one from Wisconsin, and one from Washington, which may not have been a proper balance for the steering committee. But disaster struck at the third International Elders Conference in April of 86, which met during the 3 days immediately following the RLDS conference. One participant said that there is a three-way struggle for control of the IEC, the International Elders Conference, between Zion's branch and Independence, the Church of Christ Restored from Michigan, and the Church of the Lamb of God, which is sort of spread out from Maine to Washington. But this was particularly true in April 86. The seven-member steering committee had established an agenda, which was mailed, as I said, to the people before the conference. But Dennis Cato of Independence, who was the chairman of the conference, unbeknownst to five of his colleagues on the steering committee, he gave the floor to his brother, John Cato, who proceeded to read a revelation that he'd received, calling himself to be a prophet, and naming three witnesses to attest to his calling. These three witnesses are all from Zion's branch. The three witnesses came forward and signed the revelation, attesting its validity. Well, this was the beginning of what may be the end of the International Elders Conference. The conference voted not to sustain the inspired document. See, in our LDS church, we've always wanted to sustain them. Many participants left during the conference. 1 year later, only 45 elders were back for the April 87 conference, and only 31 or so remained throughout the whole affair to vote in the sessions. A resolution to reorganize the church was defeated by a narrow margin. And it was reported that a serious lack of unity existed among the elders there. And so one problem is that many of the independent branches distrust each other as much as they distrust the institutional church. Well, with the International Elders Conference in disarray, the Michigan group is now ready to formally reorganize the reorganization. You know, you need to do this every century or so. So in a letter that I received just the other day, well, within the last month, dated July 27th, and mailed from Lawton, Michigan, the Michigan group called for a conference for the purpose of reorganizing the church to be held in Sheboygan September 11th to 13th. So if any of you are free, you'd be eligible to attend. All elders who accept various propositions are invited. In an apparent break with the Zion's branch people in Independence, the letter criticizes Dennis Cato for breaking faith in his actions in chairing the April conference of 86, which resulted in the collapse of the International Elders Conference. The letter asserts that Independence is not a good place to meet, and that a rural area is to be preferred, such as we used in the 1850s when we reorganized the church. They intend to use the name the Church of Christ Restored. Apparently asserting preeminence among the various splinter groups, the Michigan letter notes that Michigan has the highest organization to date, with a district and all kinds of branches throughout the country. They had a district conference in April of 87 in Michigan, in which light came to a patriarch directing them to further organize the Church of Christ Restored. And so as a result, we're going to have the September conference, at which they're going to establish a partial quorum of seven apostles. That may sound interesting, but there's historical precedent for that. And they all function until the Lord calls his prophet. This is following the pattern of the reorganization, as I said. We called just seven the first time around in the 1850s. Timing seems very important in reorganizing an apostate restoration church. The IEC wisely did not want to be regarded as a church. Rather, they sought to invite all the elders together and talk over what they ought to do. They wisely rejected suggestions that they create a new church or recognize a prophet, and they rejected the one attempt to recognize a prophet. But that group seems to run its course because of the Cato disaster. The Michigan group probably does not have a broad enough base among the dissidents to claim a very large fraction of them. The decision to meet in northern Michigan, far away from the RLDS population center, is going to make it hard for them to attract a very big base, to send out notices of the meeting less than two months before the meeting, to go ahead and ordain apostles. Those probably all have a tendency to narrow their ability to attract a large group. And probably the most serious weakness of the Michigan group is that they have insisted that if you want to vote at their conference in September, you have to formally join the Church of Christ Restored, which you can get into on the basis of your RLDS baptism, but you have to show evidence of having formally withdrawn from the RLDS Church, the current apostate RLDS Church. So many dissidents simply are not ready to take that drastic a step. So at this time, it appears that the Michigan group will soon have a new church organization in place with apostles, but they've got some serious obstacles if they're going to claim a very large following. And the elders, so far, the people have rejected, John Cato's claims. They rejected the other prophet, Gene Walton. There's been no movement to Stan King up in Ontario. So we've got three prophets, but no wide consensus on any of them, and lots more people just simply meeting independently. So probably most dissidents will reject Michigan as well, and some will simply insist that they must wait for a descendant of Joseph Smith, because that was what God told Jason Briggs to do in the 1850s. So Paul, you might want to apply. But I should think that as they look at the options within the Smith family, such as Paul over here, some will decide that God doesn't really want to have much more to do with the Smith clan either. A more cautious approach has been taken by the Association of Independent Groups and Branches. They held a two-day conference in October of 86, 6 months after the fatal International Elders Conference. They, representatives from 15 independent branches, met, and they are strictly an interim organization. They help independent groups organize, any group that's proceeding in the direction of starting a new church, though, they are dismissed from this association. The association will not make judgments about any claims to the prophetic office. Their leader told me that if somebody got up in their meeting and said, "Well, I've got a revelation that so-and-so is supposed to be prophet," they would say, "Well, go meet someplace else. Our association doesn't deal with that question," which I think is a very wise and pragmatic policy. And if everybody went and followed one or more different prophets within this association, would no longer be in existence. So there's quite a diversity of responses. So finally, let me make a comparative note to conclude this report. To the best of my knowledge, the LDS Church, headquartered in Utah, did not have significant internal opposition to the revelation opening the priesthood to blacks 9 years ago. In the RLDS Church, as we've seen, there has been significant internal discontent and schism, even though at the 86 World Conference, the fundamentalists' attempts to set aside or delay implementation of the new policy on women were soundly defeated. Nevertheless, very probably, one or more permanent schismatic groups will come into existence as a result of Section 156. Excuse me. One reason the LDS transition to blacks in the priesthood was easier is the fact that priesthood denial to blacks is more controversial than exclusion of women. The LDS church took a lot of heat from the outside world for its position on blacks. On the other hand, the RLDS church was not the only church that admitted only men to holy orders. One might mention the slightly larger Roman Catholic Church, for example. Perhaps a more important reason is the fact that the RLDS have the political right to challenge a revelation, at least initially. When a revelation is brought to the World Conference, the Quorum of High Priests, chaired by President Paul Madison Edwards, will consider the document and then vote on whether or not they favor its acceptance. Meanwhile, the other quorums, the gathering meetings of all the bishops and all the patriarchs, 70s, elders, and so forth, in their quorums will also discuss the document. And then these quorums will report their recommendation to the conference, and after discussion, the conference votes on whether or not to accept this document as a revelation to be included in the Doctrine and Covenants. The different traditions in the LDS and the RLDS Church on this matter arose from the historical circumstances at the time of the death of Joseph Smith. The Latter-day Saints in Utah descended, in my opinion anyway, descended from those who were most loyal to Joseph Smith, accepting the new doctrines and practices that he introduced, even when they conflicted with what they had previously thought to be true and virtuous. William Clayton, whose life is so ably chronicled in Jim Allen's recent biography, is a good example of the loyal soldier who revered his leader and never seemed to doubt anything his leader ever said. But the RLDS Church began as a dissenting sect, and it is probably easier for RLDS members today to openly express dissent than it is for most of their cousins in Utah. A reading of Stephen LeSueur's excellent book on the 1838 Missouri War, as well as our knowledge of Nauvoo, should lead us to a recognition that, and this is something RLDS don't understand, but it should lead us to the recognition that those who didn't approve of some of the things that Joseph Smith did in Far West and Nauvoo were often the persons who either left Mormonism or joined with the schismatics who refused to go west, and of which the RLDS Church became eventually captured the lion's share of them. The reasons for the dissent in Far West and Nauvoo is not hard to find. There is much to criticize in what Joseph Smith did during these years, and those that were unhappy, many of them ended up in the RLDS Church. So today's RLDS fundamentalists are in a similar situation as the dissenters who formed the reorganization in the 1850s, and some of the things I said today shows they recognize that. The International Elders Conference and the Michigan Group and others are using the precedents established then. What we have here, then, is another classic case of a sect becoming more acculturated, becoming more like a denomination, and as this happens, elements within the church or sect become dissatisfied at the departure from the traditional sectarian position, and often schism results. The RLDS fundamentalists of today exhibit many of the characteristics of the sect as developed by Ernst Troeltsch and Richard Niebuhr and others. They are particularistic, seeing themselves as the faithful remnant. They're often judgmental toward those who do not agree with them. They tend to be fundamentalist in theology and are hostile or indifferent to the secular society and to the state. The RLDS fundamentalists are upset because the RLDS church is becoming more like a denomination than the sect that they once were, that they grew up in. The RLDS church is more accommodating with the secular world and the authority of the state than they would like them to be. They are less literal in their interpretation of the scriptures than they used to be. Leadership comes more and more through a formal, trained clergy approved by authorities at the top of the church structure, like Paul Edwards at the Temple School, for example, in his priesthood preparation courses. They have a more tolerant and friendly attitude toward other religious bodies. Membership is drawn more from the middle class, while the sect draws more from the lower socioeconomic strata of society. So it seems to me that whether the RLDS fundamentalists can come together largely under one umbrella will be determined by the political skill of those who lead it. If the leaders of the various factions can compromise their own vested interests for the good of the whole, they may succeed in drawing a decent minority of the RLDS Church with them. Above all, they will eventually have to come up with a single leader, a prophet, that all or most can agree on, and that will be difficult. And if that doesn't happen, then the movement may disintegrate and probably will disintegrate into dozens of small independent branches about the size of the Strangites, whose 300 or so members who are still living today are still waiting for God to call a prophet to succeed the prophet James J. Strang, who died just 131 years ago.
Was very much like a scene from William Faulkner's Intruder in the Dust. A bright sun was breaking in the morning as individuals slipped carefully into the building. Outside the courtroom, persons were carrying signs and milling around in clusters of lostness that is attributed to dissenters. Inside the church building were gathered witnesses to speak for and against Richard Price, apologist, propagandist of the New Wave fundamentalist. Called together by the defense as evidence of the church's apostasy was a significant collection of persons upon whom this blame must fall. Never had so many liberals been gathered in one room since Thomas Jefferson was in the White House. William Dean Russell was on the list of those to attend, but was conspicuous by his absence. Some there questioned why he had not come, and much of the milling around and the discussing that went on during that time was finally summed up in this suggestion that if someone yelled out, "Will the real institutional villain stand up?" Bill wouldn't know whether to get up or not. What was happening there, and the reason Bill was on the list, if not in the room, was very much to do with what he's writing. For the decision to try this vocal dissenter was evidence of the RLDS Church's decision to push for a confrontation model in its relation to what has been called, at least locally, the New Wave fundamentalists. It places many of us in a difficult position. In the first place, we are seen as the liberals who have influenced the church and thus are responsible for making it what is now becoming a mirror of the Protestant community, as Bill has pointed out. And while the so-called liberals are themselves upset over the church's reluctance to accept a more liberal understanding and in their handling of dissenters, they find that the liberals are, for the first time, the institutional enemy. Bill Russell, longtime dissenter, friend of the outcast, fellow wanderer and exile, is, let's face it, also the status quo institution against which this dissent is being directed. Considering the circumstances, I think Bill Russell did a very fine job of collecting and documenting his paper, for much of this information is extremely hard to find, and there are obviously a variety of points of view on about everything he had to say. His analysis of what was going on and what seems to be coming from that, I think, is obviously very insightful. Bill is sometimes liberal, as an old friend of mine, Alma Breyer, used to say, in a narrow sense. But in this case, he has been more than fair and certainly less boisterous than one might have imagined, given this particular topic and this particular audience. Thus, instead of challenging much of what Bill has said, as some might think I would rather like to make some comments about it, maybe point out some things for your and hopefully his edification. The first has to do with Bill's analysis of the supporters of Section 156. I agree that the majority were in favor. Some were against in the beginning, but for one reason or another saw the light and decided to support it, and that a third and increasingly large group failed to see any light whatsoever and thus have dissented to what it said. There is a fourth group, however, and one that is hard to deal with, or at least hard to pinpoint. But this is a fairly significant group of people, which is, I believe, growing. It is composed of those persons who are dead set against women in the priesthood, but for one or two reasons have consistently voted with the document and with the prophet. The first reason is that they accept the direction given about the temple in the same document and see this issue as far more important than the women's issue. They have chosen to accept the one, women in the priesthood, until such time as it is rescinded by further light, shades of the baptism for the dead, and this frees them to vote in a positive manner for the temple. The second group that Bill hinted on are persons for whom the existence of the prophet is so essential to their religious conviction that they vote with him even when they are firmly convinced he is wrong. This group is not vocal, nor is it large, but it is certainly present. Second has to do with Bill's analysis of the RLDS who are leaving the fold. There is, I think, another identifiable group that is large enough to warrant some consideration. For by lack of a better name, let us call them disillusioned liberals. This group is composed of members of subsequent minorities within the structure, the gays, variations of constitutionalists, and so forth, who feel that the church's failure to deal with dissent has been the last straw. Like the hero of Thomas Fleming's provocative new novel, the members of the elite have discovered that they have become members and leaders of an organization which is so corrupt they want nothing to do with it. In the outset, what they are saying is that the move to oust four pastors in Blue Valley Stake serves as one example of this. The local authority said the four dissenting pastors were out and named four new pastors. The dissenters objected and by the use of force, in a literal sense, prevented the new pastors from coming in. At this point, the apostle in charge of the area backed down, leaving the local stake president out on a limb and has denied the actual movement of the stake in any other manner ever since. This one event has led to us to an identifiable number of persons simply saying the church cannot maintain its dignity and thus is not worthy of continuance. The third comment has to do with Bill's analysis of the RLDS response. Once again, I believe Bill's done a good job of pulling together information, but he has either missed or has not been aware of the latest developments in Blue Valley Stake. Recently there, the stake developed a task force composed of nearly 80 persons whose job it was to negotiate a compromise within the stake which would allow it to function. The dissidents have the vote to control the stake conference. The administration has the power not to call a stake conference. And thus, everyone sits waiting for something to happen. What this task force is trying to do is to establish a voting procedure which will allow persons to vote, quote, no, by reason of conviction, close quote, but that these votes will count as neither a yes nor a no in a business meeting. The reason this is seen as so important is that it is designed to change the institutional nature about which business is done, and has no discussion of or dealing with the theological implications of Section 156. I think it goes without saying that the RLDS response to the dissidents has in the main been a bureaucratic response. The concern is not so much that persons don't buy 156, but that they're challenging the authority of the church. And the response of the hierarchy has been to that challenge of authority. Congregations that sit by quietly disbelieving are left alone. Congregations that continue to believe but make bureaucratic noise are shut down. The fourth comment has to do with Bill's analysis and conclusion, and I would suggest three things here that might merit some further consideration. First of all, I think he misreads the importance of the temple within the same document. Considerable number of dissenters is related to the temple, either its failure to reflect the Old Jerusalem gospel on the one hand, or the fact that one is building a temple representing an ancient idea for a modern church. think a second question I would have is that I don't believe, and I don't think Bill does after his added his comments, that many of these dissenters are waiting for descendants of Joseph Smith to come and take over. In the first place, there are so many descendants of Joseph Smith, you wouldn't know who to select. But more important than that, most of these dissenters are not going back to the pre-Wallace Smith days, or Israel Smith, or Fred M. Smith. Many of them are stating that their dissent comes from the fact that the church has moved progressively away from its original intent and refer to the time as the early 1830s. They want to be reorganized or reconstituted or reaffirmed or whatever you do back into the 1830s. They have no interest in anything which reeks of the changes or alterations, including whatever was behind the reorganization. I think a third point here that the RLDS response to dissenters, as Bill presents them, is a little bit overawing. I think one might get the impression that somebody was in charge of dissent control and sat up there with a hammer pounding on people's fingers. I think the question of dissent is a question, as I mentioned, over bureaucracy. It's also a matter of degree. Blue Valley Stake, the one we've been talking so much about here, which is the hotbed of dissent in the sense of disagreement with 156, also is the home stake for a whole series of fairly liberal or radical, depending on where you come from, congregations. CCC, the Contemporary Christian Community, which is basically a hard rock church. The charismatic meet group that meets in my congregation Sunday evenings, somewhat extreme on the other side. All kinds of the Heritage House, the Hope Foundation, several missions of kinds designed to provide dissenting points of view as long as they are not dissenting against bureaucratic authority. I agree with Bill that the dissent is growing. It is increasingly bureaucratic, as I've said, and this dissent exists not only among persons who have left the church, but among persons who have chosen to remain within it. The response, as I can tell, is basically unorganized. I think most of these attempts to organize have been failures and will continue to be failures, but they are having an effect. And I think the effect is a very important part of what's happening. A couple of things are happening in relation to that that might be worth mentioning here. I think there are some initial signs that the church, all the way up to the top, all the way up to the First Presidency, are increasingly willing to reconsider church organization and business. There is, I might quote here, a coalition made in hell. They're talking about my congregation, in which a group of individuals identified as New Wave fundamentalists and another identified as blood-chilling liberals have come together to support and to submit legislation to alter the theodemocratic way that the church does business now, replacing it by a kind of New England town meeting, suggesting an organization which would allow individual congregations to act almost as autonomous groups. The interesting thing about this is that support for this is coming from such a varied number of places that while I doubt if that particular thing happens, there will certainly be some loosening of control over the various congregations. I think most of these folks, most of these dissenter groups, for one reason or another, will die out. I suspect to many of these groups, the Strangites will seem big. But by comparison, the institution has been altered in the process of this long argument. There are some who would suggest to you that the prophet, having made this statement, having presented this document, may well have looked back and said, literally, "My God, what have I done?" And though he recognizes its significance and importance and would support it to the end, he has been making an awful lot of gestures to the other side ever since. the attempt to compromise, or if you will, to balance out the so-called liberal and fundamental concepts of the organization. I think Bill's paper is well done. I think he presents some very important information. I hope he will maintain this flow of information coming in, and when this is all and over and done with, and these various dissenters have joined Stephen Shields' books, somewhere between the A's and the Z's, that Bill will be able to give us a complete and total account of what's happened. But in the meantime, it has certainly made being a member of the organization in Blue Valley Stake anything but dull. Thank you.
Thank these two gentlemen very much for coming. We do have a few minutes that we could entertain questions. I'd like you to ask you to address your question specifically to one or the other. I'll ask them if they will come to the microphone, because this is being recorded, repeat the question and give their answer, if that's all right. Bill, Paul, is that all right? Just come up here. Okay.
I have a question, Bill. Is it possible some of this dissent that's come about is because of the contextual format of that portion of Section 156 that deals with women, in so much that it delves into, quote, the men's area, rather than segregating it to an area specifically assigned with women alone? Is that a possible reason for the dissent?
I don't think so. I don't think there's that.
Repeat the question.
Well, the question is whether or not the context of the women in the priesthood passages in Section 156, whether that's the reason for some of the dissent, in that it's in a section dealing with traditionally men's work, and rather than in a section dealing with women.
Yeah, well, the specific titles like elder and so forth are almost identical, not some of them exactly the same, as in the men's work, rather than, with God you have God as a high priest and his wife as a high priestess, and high priestess roles differing from an elder's roles, That's what I mean.
Yeah. Right. I don't think that's was a problem at all for anybody. In other words, the RLDS Church has not had we have not developed women's roles in heaven or on earth like the LDS has. So I don't
the
think
LDS haven't either.
No. Okay. Yeah.
I have a question for both Paul and Bill. To what extent has the implementing of the priesthood for the women been carried out and affected the church? What impact has this had on the growth or decline of dissent against 156?
Well, great job. That institutional man would be better on that.
I think the question is, how is the implementation of the ordination of women affected the dissent movement? Is that correct? Well, just before I came out, a little bit of checking. We have 378 women in the priesthood at the moment. And growing. It's not growing as fast as some of us tried, but it's growing. And there are 13 pastors. I think what that has meant is that in those congregations which have accepted women in the priesthood and moved forward to act on that and now serve in conjunction with or even under the leadership of women in these areas, I think the effect has been very, very good, in the sense those congregations seem to be strong, they have something to be unified around, and there's a whole influx of new ideas and new blood that's coming in there. I think it is clearly defined, however, those congregations that are not willing to accept this and which are in dissent, and you can almost tell that by walking in the building. I mean, if you walk in there ready to go to church, the ward meeting or whatever, you would be going to what you discover are, if there are women participating, there's no discussion of the dissent. If there aren't women participating, that is what the discussion is about. So I think the way it has worked is that this has been as widespread as possible, and it has been fairly efficient in the sense of defining where that is accepted and where it's not, but you know that the line is pretty clear cut anymore between what you do. Yes. Go ahead. Do you want
to both of you? I'm interested if you could perhaps contrast the fundamentalist reaction, section 156, with the reaction at the other end of the spectrum, which, to my knowledge, is best articulated by Madeline Brunson in an article in Dialogue 2 or 3 years ago, in which, from a more liberal perspective, she suggests that that giving women the priesthood in the RLDS tradition is something of a patronizing sop, and that it doesn't really address the issues of patriarchy and of feminism. Can you maybe compare the reaction of that kind of more liberal perspective, a perspective which would also ignore or perhaps devalue the priesthood in Revelation, with the fundamentalist reaction? Is there a comparison in terms of the effect or the impact upon the institution, and is there a more long-term effect in the more liberal reaction?
Okay, the question is, as I understand it, in a nutshell, is has there been any reaction of the Madeline Brunson type, that is the extreme liberal point of view that says that the whole thing is a plot to give men more power, and the whole fundamental reaction to that? And I don't mean to be editorializing the question, but I think the answer to that is that there is not. I think Madeline Brunson, even though I happen to think she's a very brilliant lady and agree with her on this particular point, I think is a voice crying in the wilderness. I don't see any indication anyone's taking that seriously. There are some people who are just plain disgusted with the church over the whole issue. We've talked about them. And they react like disgusted people react. They leave or get mad or write snotty letters. But I don't see any evidence of that at all. Now, Bill is out in the field, we call it. Boondocks, it's sometimes called. And he may have a whole better perspective on that.
No, I think I'd agree. Like Paul, I agree with Madeline Brunson also, but I do think she is the most liberal RLDS women have, even though they recognize Madeline's point, I think have been elated that the thing has happened and are participating with it. I just wanted to respond to Dick Paul's question further. As far as implementation, I think that the implementation of 156 has increased fundamentalist dissent, because there's real resentment that the hierarchy of the church, the leadership of the church — I realize I'm using the term that the fundamentalists use here, the hierarchy, which Paul, as a member of the hierarchy, may not like — but the hierarchy decided that they would go through a very elaborate process of implementation. And so, you know, now we're going to have women and men in the priesthood. We're going to tighten it up and get rid of those who are not active and so forth. But they've promulgated these guidelines, and they've required, under Paul's auspices of Temple School, that people who want to be ordained or want to remain in good standing in the priesthood have to take Paul's courses. But the fundamentalists say that is just an attempt not to weed out the non-believers or the inactives. That's an attempt to make sure, before you can get ordination in the church or keep your status as an ordained person in the church, you've got to go through Paul's liberal courses at Temple School, or you're not going to be in. And so it's just another big weapon. Maybe I should have that as the seventh weapon of the hierarchy, because as they see it, Paul enters in Temple School as part of the hierarchy's attempt to make sure that everybody believes like the liberal apostate leaders of the church believe, or they're not going to have priesthood status.
Thank you very much for coming.